I had made him up, of course, and his pilot, too. I put Colonel Looseleaf Harper, the man who had dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki, Japan, at the controls. I made Rosewater an alcoholic in another book. I now had him reasonably well sobered up with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had him use his newfound sobriety to explore, among other things, the supposed spiritual and physical effects of sexual orgies with strangers in New York City. He was only confused so far. I could have killed him and his pilot, too, but I let them live on. So their plane touched down uneventfully. The two physicians on the disaster vehicle named Martha were Cyprian Ukwende of Nigeria and Kashdrahar Miasma from the infant nation of Bangladesh. Both were parts of the world which were famous from time to time for having the food run out. Both places were specifically mentioned, in fact, in Now It Can Be Told by Kilgore Trout. Dwayne Hoover read in that book that robots all over the world were constantly running out of fuel and dropping dead, while waiting around to test the only free-willed creature in the universe on the off chance that he should appear. At the wheel of the ambulance was Eddie Key, a young black man who was a direct descendant of Francis Scott Key, the white American patriot who wrote the national anthem. Eddie knew he was descended from Key. He could name more than 600 of his ancestors and had at least an anecdote about each. They were Africans, Indians, and white men. He knew, for instance, that his mother's side of the family had once owned the farm on which Sacred Miracle Cave was discovered, that his ancestors had called it Bluebird Farm. Here was why there were so many young foreign doctors on the hospital staff, incidentally. The country didn't produce nearly enough doctors for all the sick people it had, but it had an awful lot of money. So it bought doctors from other countries which didn't have much money. Eddie Key knew so much about his ancestry because the black part of his family had done what so many African families still do in Africa, which was to have one member of each generation whose duty it was to memorize the history of the family so far. Eddie Key had begun to store in his mind the names and adventures of ancestors on both his mother's and father's sides of his family when he was only 6 years old. As he sat in front of the disaster vehicle looking out through the windshield, he had the feeling that he himself was a vehicle, and that his eyes were windshields through which his progenitors could look if they wished to. Francis Scott Key was only one of thousands back there. On the off chance that Key might now be having a look at what had become of the United States of America so far, Eddie focused his eyes on an American flag which was stuck to the windshield. He said this very quietly, "Still waving, man." Eddie Key's familiarity with a teeming past made life much more interesting to him than it was to Dwayne, for instance, or to me, or to Kilgore Trout, or to almost any white person in Midland City that day. We had no sense of anybody else using our eyes, our hands. We didn't even know who our great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers were. Eddie Key was afloat in a river of people who were flowing from here to there in time. Dwayne and Trout and I were pebbles at rest. And Eddie Key, because he knew so much by heart, was able to have deep, nourishing feelings about Dwayne Hoover, for instance, and about Cyprian Ukwende, too. Dwayne was a man whose family had taken over Bluebird Farm. Ukwende, an Indaro, was a man whose ancestors had kidnapped an ancestor of Key's on the west coast of Africa, a man named Ojumwa. The Indaro sold him for a musket to British slave traders, who took him on a sailing ship named the Skylark to Charleston, South Carolina, where he was auctioned off as a self-propelled, self-repairing farm machine, and so on. Dwayne Hoover was now hustled aboard Martha through big double doors in her rear just ahead of the engine compartment. Eddie Key was in the driver's seat and he watched the action in his rearview mirror. Dwayne was swaddled so tightly in canvas restraining sheets that his reflection looked to Eddie like a bandaged thumb. Dwayne didn't notice the restraints. He thought he was on the virgin planet promised by the book by Kilgore Trout. Even when he was laid out horizontally by Cyprian Ukwende and Kahashtrahar Miasma, he thought he was standing up. The book had told him that he went swimming in cold water on the virgin planet, that he always yelled something surprising when he climbed out of the icy pool. It was a game. The creator of the universe would try to guess what Dwayne would yell each day, and Dwayne would fool him, totally. Here is what Dwayne yelled in the ambulance. Goodbye, Blue Monday. Then it seemed to him that another day had passed on the virgin planet, and that it was time to yell again. Not a cough in a carload, he yelled. Kilgore Trout was one of the walking wounded. He was able to climb aboard Martha without assistance, and to choose a place to sit where he would be away from real emergencies. He had jumped Dwayne Hoover from behind when Dwayne dragged Francine Pefko out of Dwayne's showroom and onto the asphalt. Dwayne wanted to give her a beating in public, which his bad chemicals made him think she richly deserved. Dwayne had already broken her jaw and three ribs in the office. When he trundled her outside, there was a fair-sized crowd which had drifted out of the cocktail lounge and the kitchen of the new Holiday Inn. "Best fucking machine in the state," he told the crowd. "Wind her up, and she'll fuck you and say she loves you, and she won't shut up till you give her a Colonel Sanders Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise." And so on. Trout grabbed him from behind. Trout's right finger somehow slipped into Dwayne's mouth, and Dwayne bit off the topmost joint. Dwayne let go of Francine after that, and she slumped to the asphalt. She was unconscious, and the most seriously injured of all. And Dwayne went cantering over to the concrete trough by the interstate, and he spat Kilgore Trout's fingertip into Sugar Creek. Kilgore Trout did not choose to lie down in Martha. He settled into a leather bucket seat behind Eddie Key. Key asked him what was the matter with him, and Trout held up his right hand, partly shrouded in a bloody handkerchief. "A slip of the lip can sink a ship," yelled Dwayne. "Remember Pearl Harbor," yelled Dwayne. Most of what he had done during the past three quarters of an hour had been hideously unjust, but he had spared Wayne Hubler, at least. Wayne was back among the used cars again, unscathed. He was picking up a bracelet, which I had pitched back there for him to find. As for myself, I kept a respectful distance between myself and all the violence, even though I had created Dwayne and his violence and the city and the sky above and the earth below. Even so, I came out of the riot with a broken watch crystal and what turned out later to be a broken toe. Somebody jumped backwards to get out of Dwayne's way. He broke my watch crystal, even though I had created him, and he broke my toe. This isn't the kind of book where people get what is coming to them at the end. Dwayne only hurt one person who deserved to be hurt for being so wicked. That was Don Breedlove. Breedlove was the white gas conversion unit installer who had raped Patty Keene, the waitress in Dwayne's Burger Chef out on Crestview Avenue, in the parking lot of George Hickman Bannister Memorial Fieldhouse, out at the county fairgrounds after Peanut University beat Innocent Bystander High School in the regional class high school basketball playoffs. Don Breedlove was in the kitchen of the inn when Dwayne began his rampage. He was repairing a defective gas oven in there. He stepped outside for some fresh air, and Dwayne came running up to him. Dwayne had just spit Kilgore Trout's fingertip into Sugar Creek. Don and Dwayne knew each other quite well, since Dwayne had once sold Breedlove a new Pontiac Ventura, which Don said was a lemon. A lemon was an automobile which didn't run right, and which nobody was able to repair. Dwayne actually lost money on the transaction, making adjustments and replacing parts in an attempt to mollify Breedlove. But Breedlove was inconsolable, and he finally painted this sign in bright yellow on his trunk lid and on both doors. "This car is a lemon." Here is what really went wrong with the car, incidentally. The child of a neighbor of Breedlove had put maple sugar in the gas tank of the Ventura. Maple sugar was a kind of candy made from the blood of trees. So Dwayne Hoover now extended his right hand to Breedlove, and Breedlove, without thinking anything about it, took that hand in his own. They linked up. This was a symbol of friendship between men. The feeling was, too, that a lot of character could be read into the way a man shook hands. Dwayne and Don Breedlove gave each other squeezes, which were dry and hard. So Dwayne held on to Don Breedlove with his right hand, and he smiled as though bygones were bygones. Then he made a cup out of his left hand, and he hit Don on the ear with the opened end of the cup. This created terrific air pressure in Don's ear. He fell down because the pain was so awful. Don would never hear anything with that ear ever again. So Don was in the ambulance, too, now, sitting up like Kilgore Trout. Francine was lying down, unconscious but moaning. Beatrice Kiedsler was lying down, although she might have sat up. Her jaw was broken. Bunny Hoover was lying down. His face was unrecognizable, even as a face, anybody's face. He had been given morphine by Cyprian Ukwende. There were five other victims as well, one white female, two white males, two black males. The three white people had never been in Midland City before. They were on their way together from Erie, Pennsylvania, to the Grand Canyon, which was the deepest crack on the planet. They wanted to look down into the crack, but they never got to do it. Dwayne Hoover assaulted them as they walked from the car toward the lobby of the new Holiday Inn. The two black males were both kitchen employees of the inn. Cyprian Ukwende now tried to remove Dwayne Hoover's shoes, but Dwayne's shoes and laces and socks were impregnated with the plastic material which he had picked up while wading across Sugar Creek. Ukwende was not mystified by plasticized, unitized shoes and socks. He saw shoes and socks like that every day at the hospital, on the feet of children who had played too close to Sugar Creek. In fact, he had hung a pair of tin snips on the wall of the hospital's emergency room for cutting off plasticized, unitized shoes and socks. He turned to his Bengali assistant, young Dr. Kahastrahar Miasma. "Get some shears," he said. Miasma was standing with his back to the door of the ladies' toilet on the emergency vehicle. He had done nothing so far to deal with all the emergencies. Ukwende and police and a team from civil defense had done the work so far. Miasma now refused even to find some shears. Basically, Miasma probably shouldn't have been in the field of medicine at all, or at least not in any area where there was a chance that he might be criticized. He could not tolerate criticism. This was a characteristic beyond his control. Any hint that anything about him was not absolutely splendid automatically turned him into a useless, sulky child who would only say that it wanted to go home. That was what he said when Ukwende told him a second time to find shears. "I want to go home." Here is what he had been criticized for. Just before the alarm came in about Dwayne's going berserk, he had amputated a black man's foot, whereas the foot could probably have been saved. And so on. I could go on and on with the intimate details about the various lives of people on the super ambulance, but what good is more information? I agree with Kilgore Trout about realistic novels and their accumulations of nitpicking details. In Trout's novel, The Pan-Galactic Memory Bank, the hero is on a spaceship 200 miles long and 62 miles in diameter. He gets a realistic novel out of the branch of the library in his neighborhood. He reads about 60 pages of it, and then he takes it back. The librarian asks him why he doesn't like it, and he says to her, "I already know about human beings," and so on. Martha began to move. Kilgore Trout saw a sign he liked a lot. Here is what it said. "It is harder to be unhappy when you are eating Craig's ice cream," and so on. Dwayne Hoover's awareness returned to Earth momentarily. He spoke of opening a health club in Midland City with rowing machines and stationary bicycles and whirlpool baths and sun lamps and a swimming pool, and so on. He told Cyprian Ukwende that the thing to do with a health club was to open it and then sell it as soon as possible for a profit. "People get all enthusiastic about getting back in shape or losing some pounds," said Dwayne. "They sign up for the program, but then they lose interest in about a year and they stop coming. That's how people are," and so on. Dwayne wasn't going to open any health club. He wasn't going to open anything ever again. The people he had injured so unjustly would sue him so vengefully that he would be rendered destitute. He would become one more withered balloon of an old man on Midland City Skid Row, which was the neighborhood of the once fashionable Fairchild Hotel. He would be, by no means, the only drifter of whom it could be truthfully said, "See him? Can you believe it? He doesn't have a doodly squat now, but he used to be fabulously well-to-do," and so on. Kilgore Trout now peeled strips and patches of plastic from his burning shins and feet in the ambulance. He had to use his uninjured left hand, etc. Epilogue. The emergency room of the hospital was in the basement. After Kilgore Trout had the stump of his ring finger disinfected and trimmed and bandaged, he was told to go upstairs to the finance office. There were certain forms he had to fill out, since he was from outside Midland County, had no health insurance, and was destitute. He had no checkbook. He had no cash. He got lost in the basement for a little while, as a lot of people did. He found the double doors to the morgue, as a lot of people did. He automatically mooned about his own mortality, as a lot of people did. He found an X-ray room, which wasn't in use. It made him wonder automatically if anything bad was growing inside himself. Other people had wondered exactly the same thing when they passed that room. Trout felt nothing now that millions of other people wouldn't have felt, automatically. And Trout found stairs, but they were the wrong stairs. They led him not to the lobby in the finance office and the gift shop and all that, but to a matrix of rooms where persons were recovering or failing to recover from injuries of all kinds. Many of the people there had been flung to the earth by the force of gravity, which never relaxed for a second. Trout passed a very expensive private room now, and there was a young black man in there with a white telephone and a colored television set and boxes of candy and bouquets of flowers all around. He was Elgin Washington, a pimp who operated out of the old Holiday Inn. He was only 26 years old, but he was fabulously well-to-do. Visiting hours had ended, so all his female sex slaves had departed, but they had left clouds of perfume behind. Trout gagged as he passed the door. It was an automatic reaction to the fundamentally unfriendly cloud. Elgin Washington had just sniffed cocaine into his sinus passages, which amplified tremendously the telepathic messages he sent and received. He felt 100 times bigger than life because the messages were so loud and exciting. It was their noise that thrilled him. He didn't care what they said. And in the midst of the uproar, Elgin Washington said something wheedlingly to Trout. "Hey, man, hey, man, hey, man," he wheedled. He had had his foot amputated earlier in the day by Kahashtrahar miasma, but he had forgotten that. "Hey, man, hey, man," he coaxed. He wanted nothing particular from Trout. Some part of his mind was idly exercising his skill at making strangers come to him. He was a fisherman for men's souls. "Hey, man," he said. He showed a gold tooth. He winked an eye. Trout came to the foot of the black man's bed. This wasn't compassion on his part. He was being machinery again. Trout was, like so many earthlings, a fully automatic boob when a pathological personality like Elgin Washington told him what to want, what to do. Both men, incidentally, were descendants of the Emperor Charlemagne. Anybody with any European blood in him was a descendant of the Emperor Charlemagne. Elgin Washington perceived that he had caught yet another human being without really meaning to. It was not in his nature to let one go without making him feel in some way diminished, in some way a fool. Sometimes he actually killed a man in order to diminish him, but he was gentle with Trout. He closed his eyes as though thinking hard, then he earnestly said, "I think I may be dying." "I'll get a nurse," said Trout. Any human being would have said exactly the same thing. "No, no," said Elgin Washington, waving his hands in dreamy protest. "I'm dying slow. It's gradual." "I see," said Trout. "You gotta do me a favor," said Washington. He had no idea what favor to ask. It would come to him. Ideas for favors always came. "What favor?" said Trout uneasily. He stiffened at the mention of an unspecified favor. He was that kind of machine. Washington knew he would stiffen. Every human being was that kind of machine. "I want you to listen to me while I whistle the song of the nightingale," he said. He commanded Trout to be silent by giving him the evil eye. "What adds peculiar beauty to the call of the nightingale, much beloved by poets," he said, "is the fact that it will only sing by moonlight." Then he did what almost every black person in Midland City would do. He imitated a nightingale. The Midland City Festival of the Arts was postponed because of madness. Fred T. Barriott's chairman came to the hospital in his limousine dressed like a Chinaman to offer his sympathy to Beatrice Kiedsler and Kilgore Trout. Trout could not be found anywhere. Beatrice Kiedsler had been put to sleep with morphine. Kilgore Trout assumed that the arts festival would still take place that night. He had no money for any form of transportation, so he set out on foot. He began the 5-mile walk down Fairchild Boulevard toward a tiny amber dot at the other end. The dot was the Midland City Center for the Arts. He would make it grow by walking toward it. When his walking had made it big enough, it would swallow him up. There would be food inside. I was waiting to intercept him about 6 blocks away. I sat in a Plymouth Duster I had rented from Avis with my Diners Club card. I had a paper tube in my mouth. It was stuffed with leaves. I set it on fire. It was a soigner thing to do. My penis was 3 inches long and 5 inches in diameter. Its diameter was a world's record as far as I knew. It slumbered now in my jockey shorts. And I got out of the car to stretch my legs, which was another soigner thing to do. I was among factories and warehouses. The streetlights were widely spaced and feeble. Parking lots were vacant except for night watchmen's cars, which were here and there. There was no traffic on Fairchild Boulevard, which had once been the aorta of the town. The life had all been drained out of it by the interstate and by the Robert F. Kennedy Interbelt Expressway, which was built on the old right-of-way of the Monon Railroad. The Monon was defunct. Defunct. Nobody slept in that part of town. Nobody lurked there. It was a system of forts at night, with high fences and alarms, and with prowling dogs. They were killing machines. When I got out of my Plymouth Duster, I feared nothing. That was foolish of me. A writer off guard, since the materials with which he works are so dangerous, can expect agony as quick as a thunderclap. I was about to be attacked by a Doberman pincer. He was a leading character in an earlier version of this book. Listen. That Doberman's name was Kazak. He patrolled the supply yard of the Maritimo Brothers Construction Company at night. Kazak's trainers, the people who explained to him what sort of planet he was on and what sort of an animal he was, taught him that the creator of the universe wanted him to kill anything he could catch and to eat it, too. In an earlier version of this book, I had Benjamin Davis, the black husband of Lottie Davis, Dwayne Hoover's maid, take care of Kazak. He threw raw meat down into the pit where Kazak lived in the daytime. He dragged Kazak into the pit at sunrise. He screamed at him and threw tennis balls at him at sundown. Then he turned him loose. Benjamin Davis was first trumpet with the Midland City Symphony Orchestra, but he got no pay for that, so he needed a real job. He wore a thick gown made of war surplus mattresses and chicken wire so Kazak could not kill him. Kazak tried and tried. There were chunks of mattress and swatches of chicken wire all over the yard. And Kazak did his best to kill anybody who came too close to the fence, which enclosed his planet. He leaped at people as though the fence weren't there. The fence bellied out toward the sidewalk everywhere. It looked as though somebody had been shooting cannonballs at it from inside. I should have noticed the queer shape of the fence when I got out of my automobile when I did the soignée thing of lighting a cigarette. I should have known that a character as ferocious as Kazak was not easily cut out of a novel. Kazak was crouching behind a pile of bronze pipe which the Maritimo brothers had bought cheap from a hijacker earlier that day. Kazak meant to kill me and eat me. I turned my back to the fence, took a deep puff of my cigarette. Pell Mells would kill me by and by. And I mooned philosophically at the murky battlements of the old Kiezler mansion on the other side of Fairchild Boulevard. Beatrice Kiezler had been raised in there. The most famous murders in the city's history had been committed there. Will Fairchild, the war hero and the maternal uncle of Beatrice Kiezler, appeared one summer night in 1926 with a Springfield rifle. He shot and killed 5 relatives, 3 servants, 2 policemen, and all the animals in the Kiezler's private zoo. Then he shot himself through his heart. When an autopsy was performed on him, a tumor the size of a piece of birdshot was found in his brain. This was what caused the murders. After the Kiezlers lost the mansion at the start of the Great Depression, Fred T. Barry and his parents moved in. The old place was filled with the sounds of British birds. It was silent property of the city now, and there was talk of making it into a museum where children could learn the history of Midland City, as told by arrowheads and stuffed animals and white men's early artifacts. Fred T. Barry had offered to donate $500,000 to the proposed museum on one condition: that the first robo-magic and the early posters which advertised it be put on display. And he wanted the exhibit to show, too, how machines evolved just as animals did, but with much greater speed. I gazed at the Kiezler mansion, never dreaming that a volcanic dog was about to erupt behind me. Kilgore Trout came nearer. I was almost indifferent to his approach, although we had momentous things to say to one another about my having created him. I thought instead of my paternal grandfather, who had been the first licensed architect in Indiana. He had designed some dream houses for Hoosier millionaires. They were mortuaries and guitar schools and cellar holes and parking lots now. I thought of my mother, who drove me around Indianapolis one time during the Great Depression to impress me with how rich and powerful my maternal grandfather had been. She showed me where his brewery had been, where some of his dream houses had been. Every one of the monuments was a cellar hole. Kilgore Trout was only a half a block from his creator now and slowing down. I worried him. I turned toward him so that my sinus cavities, where all telepathic messages were sent and received, were lined up symmetrically with his. I told him this over and over telepathically. I have good news for you. Kazak sprung. I saw Kazak out of the corner of my right eye. His eyes were pinwheels. His teeth were white daggers. His slobber was cyanide. His blood was nitroglycerin. He was floating toward me like a zeppelin, hanging lazily in air. My eyes told my mind about him. My mind sent a message to my hypothalamus, told it to release the hormone CRF into the short vessels connecting my hypothalamus and my pituitary gland. The CRF inspired my pituitary gland to dump the hormone ACTH into my bloodstream. My pituitary had been making and storing ACTH for just such an occasion. And nearer and nearer the zeppelin came. And some of the ACTH in my bloodstream reached the outer shell of my adrenal gland, which had been making and storing glucocorticoids for emergencies. My adrenal gland added the glucocorticoids to my bloodstream. They went all over my body, changing glycogen into glucose. Glucose was muscle food. It would help me fight like a wildcat or run like a deer. And nearer the zeppelin came. My adrenal gland gave me a shot of adrenaline, too. I turned purple as my blood pressure skyrocketed. The adrenaline made my heart go like a burglar alarm. It also stood my hair on end. It also caused coagulants to pour into my bloodstream, so, in case I was wounded, my vital juices wouldn't drain away. Everything my body had done so far fell within normal operating procedures for a human machine. But my body took one defensive measure which I am told was without precedent in medical history. It may have happened because some wire short-circuited or some gasket blew. At any rate, I also retracted my testicles into my abdominal cavity, pulled them into my fuselage like the landing gear of an airplane. And now they tell me that only surgery will bring them down again. Be that as it may, Kilgore Trout watched me from a half a block away, not knowing who I was, not knowing about Kazakh, and what my body had done about Kazakh so far. Trout had had a full day already, but it wasn't over yet. Now he saw his creator leap completely over an automobile. I landed on my hands and knees in the middle of Fairchild Boulevard. Kazakh was flung back by the fence. Gravity took charge of him as it had taken charge of me. Gravity slammed him down on concrete. Kazakh was knocked silly. Kilgore Trout turned away. He hastened anxiously back toward the hospital. I called out to him, but that only made him walk faster. So I jumped into my car and chased him. I was still high as a kite on adrenaline and coagulants and all that. I did not know yet that I had retracted my testicles in all the excitement. I felt only vague discomfort down there. Trout was cantering when I came alongside. I clocked him at 11 miles an hour, which was an excellent run for a man his age. He, too, was now full of adrenaline and coagulants and glucocorticoids. My windows were rolled down, and I called this to him. "Whoa, whoa, Mr. Trout, whoa, Mr. Trout!" It slowed him down to be called by name. "Whoa, I'm a friend," I said. He shuffled to a stop, leaned in panting exhaustion against a fence surrounding an appliance warehouse belonging to the General Electric Company. The company's monogram and motto hung in the night sky behind Kilgore Trout, whose eyes were wild. The motto was this: "Progress is our most important product." "Mr. Trout," I said from the unlighted interior of the car, "you have nothing to fear. I bring you tidings of great joy." He was slow to get his breath back, so he wasn't much of a conversationalist at first. Are you from the arts festival?" he said. His eyes rolled and rolled. "I am from the Everything Festival," I replied. "The what?" he said. I thought it would be a good idea to let him have a good look at me, and so attempted to flick on the dome light. I turned on the windshield washers instead. I turned them off again. My view of the lights of the county hospital was garbled by beads of water. I pulled at another switch, and it came away in my hand. It was a cigarette lighter. So I had no choice but to continue to speak from darkness. "Mr. Trout," I said, "I am a novelist, and I created you for use in my books." "Pardon me," he said. "I am your creator," I said. "You are in the middle of a book right now, close to the end of it, actually." "Urn," he said. "Are there any questions you'd like to ask?" "Pardon me," he said. "Feel free to ask anything you want, about the past, about the future," I said. "There's a Nobel Prize in your future." "A what?" he said. "A Nobel Prize in medicine." "Huh," he said. It was a noncommittal sound. "I've also arranged for you to have a reputable publisher from now on. No more beaver books for you." "Ugh," he said. "If I were in your spot, I would certainly have lots of questions," I said. "Do you have a gun?" he said. I laughed there in the dark, tried to turn on the light again, activated the windshield washer again. "I don't need a gun to control you, Mr. Trout. All I have to do is write down something about you, and that's it." "Are you crazy?" he said. "No," I said. And I shattered his power to doubt me. I transported him to the Taj Mahal, and then to Venice, and then to Dar es Salaam, and then to the surface of the sun where the flames could not consume him, and then back to Midland City again. The poor old man crashed to his knees. He reminded me of the way my mother and Bunny Hoover's mother used to act whenever somebody tried to take their photographs. As he cowered there, I transported him to the Bermuda of his childhood, had him contemplate the infertile egg of a Bermuda urn. I took him from there to the Indianapolis of my childhood. I put him in a circus crowd there. I had him see a man with a locomotor ataxia and a woman with a goiter as big as a zucchini. I got out of my rented car. I did it noisily so his ears would tell him a lot about his creator, even if he was unwilling to use his eyes. I slammed the car door firmly. As I approached him from the driver's side of the car, I swiveled my feet some so that my footsteps were not only deliberate but gritty, too. I stopped with the tips of my shoes on the rim of the narrow field of his downcast eyes. "Mr. Trout, I love you," I said gently. "I have broken your mind to pieces. I want to make it whole. I want you to feel a wholeness and inner harmony such as I have never allowed you to feel before. I want you to raise your eyes to look at what I have in my hand. I had nothing in my hand, but such was my power over Trout that he would see in it whatever I wished him to see. I might have shown him a Helen of Troy, for instance, only 6 inches tall. "Mr. Trout, Kilgore," I said, "I hold in my hand a symbol of wholeness and harmony and nourishment. It is Oriental in its simplicity, but we are Americans, Kilgore, and not Chinamen. We Americans require symbols which are richly colored and three-dimensional and juicy. Most of all, we hunger for symbols which have not been poisoned by great sins our nation has committed, such as slavery and genocide and criminal neglect, or by tin-horn commercial greed and cunning." "Look up, Mr. Trout," I said, and I waited patiently. "Kilgore?" The old man looked up, and he had my father's wasted face when my father was a widower, when my father was an old, old man. He saw that I held an apple in my hand. "I am approaching my 50th birthday, Mr. Trout," I said. "I am cleansing and renewing myself for the very different sorts of years to come. Under similar spiritual conditions, Count Tolstoy freed his serfs. Thomas Jefferson freed his slaves. I am going to set at liberty all the literary characters who have served me so loyally during my writing career. You are the only one I am telling. For the others, tonight will be a night like any other night. Arise, Mr. Trout. You are free. You are free." He arose, shamblingly. I might have shaken his hand, but his right hand was injured, so our hands remained dangling at our sides. "Bon voyage," I said. I disappeared. I somersaulted lazily and pleasantly through the void, which is my hiding place when I dematerialize. Trout's cries to me faded as the distance between us increased. His voice was my father's voice. I heard my father, and I saw my mother in the void. My mother stayed far, far away, because she had left me a legacy of suicide. A small hand mirror floated by. It was a leek with a mother-of-pearl handle and frame. I captured it easily, held it up to my own right eye. Here's what Kilgore Trout cried out to me in my father's voice. "Make me young. Make me young. Make me young," etc.
I'm Donald Farber Kurtz, longtime friend and attorney. I'd like to ask you a question, Kurt. How are we going to solve the ills of the world, Kurt?
Well, God, I would have to reread Breakfast of Champions to respond to it.
Okay, you can go see the movie again. Yeah,
no, please.
I was there with you when you saw it the last time.
Yeah.
It was painful.
Yeah.
You know, painful.
No, as I recall, it was about an arts festival out in the Middle West. And I think those are comical. And it starred a character of mine, is Kilgore Trout, who's been in several other of my novels, who is an out-of-print science fiction writer. actually, I was talking to an editor friend of mine, actually a guy who was at Cornell with me and then became an editor and now an agent in New York, is Knox Berger. But years ago, I was talking to him about science fiction stories and everything. So I started inventing Kilgore's Trout stories because I didn't want to write out the whole damn thing, you know, page after page after page. And one of them is about the planet Trout-Famador, which is also an invention of mine, where the people communicate by tap dancing and farting. And so they realize that we're in trouble here, that we've got cancer and war and a whole lot of stuff, and they've got answers to these problems. And so they send a flying saucer here with one of their guys, and this Trout-Famadorian lands his flying saucer there on the edge of a golf course. And the golf pro lives right next to the course there and everything. His house is on fire. So the Trout-Famadorian goes rushing into the house because everybody's asleep, tell him that the house is on fire and he's by the golf pro's bed tap dancing and farting. And the golf pro kills him with a 5-iron. It's a failure, tragic failure of communication.
I would say so. That's very funny.
It's been a long time since I read Breakfast of Champions.
I got to confess, me too. It just so happens the whole Vonnegut family, they're all remarkable artists.
Well,
Nanny, yes, Edie.
But, all right, but I'm...
Tell us about that, because that's exciting.
My grandfather, Bernard Vonnegut, was an architect, and as part of an architect's job then was to do watercolors, you know, to do renderings, and he was pretty good. He would even do interiors of houses he designed and watercolors. And then my father became an architect, became his partner, and father painted. And so, yeah, I think it is in the blood probably, but I tell you, everybody ought to paint, whether he or she is any good at it or not, because it is so indecently rewarding, and it's more damn fun.
But Edie's work is stunning.
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's breathtakingly
beautiful. Well, if you like El Greco, sure.
Hey, I like yours, too. Come on. You've done a couple there. Some of them were really, really astonishing.
What I do is paint on acetate, one acetate for each color, as paint on with opaque inks like India ink. And then a guy out in Kentucky, is Joe Petro III, makes silkscreen prints of them. And what is great about silkscreen prints is that the colors, the inks, are actually paints. And so these silkscreen really jumps out at you. The colors are so rich as compared to other kinds of print. Joe Petro and I have more than 200 images now. That's a lot. And now we are putting together a catalog, and we're starting to sell them, Counselor.
They're
mean,
great.
That's,
I
look,
know.
You don't represent me as a painting.
No, no, but I see he sends me a record of everything, so I see what's going
on.
What,
have you been skimming the account anyway?
No, I don't have to. Can I sneak in another question? I'm probably one of the few people who know you have a talent as a musician also. Do we talk about that? You don't want to talk about that.
That's just fraternity house piano.
Well, that's great, though.
Yeah.
It's barrel house stuff. Yeah. You wouldn't associate yourself with a fraternity house now, would you?
Well, I went to Cornell University, and fraternities were Cornell, and sororities were Cornell's solutions to the housing problem. They had dorms for freshmen men and women. After that, you were supposed to join a fraternity. I think there were 55 separate fraternities at Cornell, and remembering my fraternity brothers in Delta Upsilon, we were just all in the same rooming house, I think, in the same boarding house. It was no big deal. But our motto was De Kai Upiteki, which means justice is our foundation. And yes, I think I've lived like that.
Yeah, well, it's just what's happened with some of the fraternities now is the hazing's gotten out of hand and the drinking's gotten out of hand and...
Look, it used to be funny to be drunk.
Dorothy Parker did a lot with the martini.
Yeah.
That whole gang, the whole...
But when I went to Cornell and then joined a fraternity, drinking was part of it on a weekend. And since, I don't know, 6 or 8% of the general population is alcoholic, is potentially alcoholic, that's a huge whack of my fraternity brothers who went under, Thinking about Prohibition, remember what an Indianapolis humorist, I'm from Indianapolis, and Ken Hubbard was an Indianapolis humorist during the Prohibition era, and he said that Prohibition was certainly a lot better than no liquor at all.
So I must say, I usually end up laughing when I talk to you, so you've done it again.
All right.
There's always something funny about something that isn't funny. You managed to find it.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or CDs, or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. You might also try our website, www.harperaudio.com. Thank you.